What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, in this particular podcast, we are right in the middle of a really hot topic that is emerging in our culture. And I love it when we can dig into this, particularly with an expert like Mark Edelman, who's a law professor, an attorney, and a sports business expert. And what I'm talking about here is, and let's put this issue on the line, on firing line, should college athletes be paid? See, that's the topic.
Yeah, on the surface, I would say no.
Okay, and that's how many people react.
Because, I mean, they're going to college, right? They're getting an education.
A great education in basket weaving at the University of Miami. Yes, go on. Make your case.
And, you know, it gets a real sticky area when you start.
When I'm in my dorm room or the library and I'm studying for finals and they're on a bus somewhere between Toledo and Dayton and they're at a practice for 6 hours the day before and, you know, their college experience is a little bit different, many of them, than ours.
I didn't realize that.
And when in fact, well, here we are in the state of Connecticut. So, John, having been kind of part of the phenomenon, because I kind of brought the UConn women to television, so basketball team, of course, that has become legendary over time. So you look at it and you say to yourself, well, what's the best marketing tool that the University of Connecticut has?
UConn basketball.
All right. So the women and the men. So can you put a value on that, what these young men and women are doing? Now, you look at it, we're still selling the shirts of Diana Taurasi, her number, because Gino Auriemma does not allow them to have their names on the back like the Yankees.
Right.
Some venerable institutions don't believe that any of the passing through should be acknowledged because they are part of the Yankees or part of UConn women's basketball. But nonetheless, we're still selling the jerseys.
Right.
Still
no,
making
that's true.
A little
still
bit of money.
Money.
Yep. On the other hand, I mean, Gino would argue, all right, I'll give up all the revenue that we've gotten on Diana's jersey if we could have a piece of what she's made in the WNBA and all the endorsements she's done subsequently because of her experience at UConn. Now, someone else may argue, well, for every Diana Taurasi who came out and had a great career in the WNBA, which, by the way, is not paid in any way like the NBA, there are tons of other young women athletes, who'd never went anywhere after.
Right.
So, I mean, there are many, many strands to this argument. But one thing that I don't think anybody can argue about is the fact that there are a lot of people making a lot of money on the backs of the college athlete.
That's true.
And look at ESPN in our own backyard.
Yeah.
I mean, they built a whole industry and Fox Sports and this one and that one and all the cable providers and all the advertisers on these, the Gillettes and the this and so forth. And then, of course, there are the athletic directors and, might I add, the coaches.
Yes, who are making more money than anybody in the state.
Well, those who are heads of state programs, I mean, if they're making $5 million to coach Michigan's football team, I mean, let's be honest about it. There are people making money here. So the question is, should that money be rolled around and in some way, beyond the scholarship, come back to benefit the athlete? And the reason, John, that I say that we're in the middle of this conversation in America is that California has just passed a law suggesting that likenesses and images of these college athletes, and we recognize that we're only talking about a few sports and some major universities, because somebody playing Division II or Division III lacrosse is not one who's going to be highlighted in any way or make money from their likeness, but there are some in football and basketball particularly who are going to be making that money. So California passed a law saying if Nike wants to give them some money, they should be able to accept it. Wow. Now, the NCAA has been against that for years. Then they came out and said, well, I guess we're going to have to throw a little nice, warm water on this and say, yeah, we're kind of getting there. We're there. But I've read, even though we did this interview right before all of this took place, I read where basically the NCAA is saying yes, but will do nothing to really forward promote more compensation to the athletes. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see where that goes. But it's interesting because we were talking about the state of Connecticut, and one of our senators here in Connecticut, Chris Murphy, has really been an advocate of looking at this whole issue of compensation for athletes. And he put out a 15-page report about the NCAA cherry-picking various news outlets for comment, but he was really looking at it and saying that we have to get on the side of the athlete and think about their own benefit and what it is that they're doing for universities and for college athletics and find a way to compensate them for their efforts. And their efforts really involve a lot of sacrifice. They're different than the average college student. They really are.
Wow. I sort of wonder sometimes if we spend too much time and money on sports in schools and shouldn't be spending more time and money on math and engineering and stuff, but that's me.
Well, you know, the other thing that has happened, of course, we've expanded sports in college to the degree that we want men and women to have a comparable experience. So you've got Title IX, and so you built out programs. If you're going to have one in field hockey for the men, you have it for the women. And that seems very fair. But you look at all of this, and there are many schools not making any money on college athletics. None
right.
at all. So some would say, well, won't this be a hardship for them? Well, we talk about a lot of these issues with a guy who really knows the inside and the out of this issue of college athletics, the money involved, and what we should be doing more than we are today for the athlete. Mark Edelman is with us today on America Trends.
With me on the line on America is Mark Edelman. He's a law professor, an attorney, and sports business expert, writing an awful lot about college athletics, and there's been a great debate going on in America for many years now as to whether college athletes, particularly Division I and basketball and football in particular, should be compensated beyond the scholarships. And Attorney Edelman, you've been pretty clear that you feel that compensation is warranted for these student athletes, and we'll get into your reasoning. But first, let's define the athletes and types of programs that we're talking about, because there are so many programs now, particularly with Title I, that are not generating any revenue. So are we just talking about a couple of major sports and major conferences?
Well, it depends what type of compensation you're talking about, because in the grand scheme of things, there are two worlds of compensation for college athletes. One which would theoretically allow schools to pay money to recruit athletes. The other would be simply deregulating third-party endorsement deals, which would be aimed at allowing college athletes, much like any other college student, should they have the ability to endorse products for money. With respect to the first category, I think realistically we're looking at a limited number of athletes in a limited number of sports at a limited number of schools who bring tremendous revenue potential to these schools who are being denied the opportunity to compete in the free market for their service. In the other area, the endorsement area, we are dealing with probably several thousands of athletes who are being restrained. And we're not just talking about elite football and men's basketball players. We're talking about gymnasts and swimmers and other people who might be well-known on campus, who might be able to endorse, say, a local pizzeria for a small amount of money or receive free clothing from their favorite provider in exchange for endorsing their product.
And are these payments that we're talking about in addition to scholarships or in lieu of them?
Neither. A small number of these athletes would be non-scholarship students, but these would be, to the extent we're talking about, in addition to scholarships. If we could talk a little bit more about the scholarships, however, this notion that the athletes are fully compensated by the scholarship that they're receiving is probably a severe mischaracterization of the reality. First, many of these athletes are from low-income families, which means that they would probably not be paying for their college directly anyway. They would be qualifying for Pell Grants or other opportunities that are afforded to low-income students. The scholarship is also supposed to be guaranteeing them a traditional version of an education. But in the big-time commercial sports, the education that these athletes are getting pale in comparison with the general education at the school. I mean, if you look, for example, at Syracuse University basketball, and from my perspective, they're one of the worst offenders out there. They just switched athletic conferences in which they compete in, and they now compete in the Atlantic Coastal Conference, which, if you think about it, is kind of ridiculous that a school in Syracuse, New York, is playing most of its games in the Carolinas. If you look at all of the number of days during the basketball season that the Syracuse men's basketball team are pulled out of class to be sent on the road to the Carolinas to play basketball, to maximize revenue for that school, based on calculations I did several years ago, if that team were to advance to the NCAA men's basketball tournament finals, at a minimum, they would miss 25% of class days. So it's hard to call the scholarship a true value in terms of free education, when first, that might not be the fair market price for what the athletes are providing, and second, one could really question whether they're even receiving that education.
How much of the debate that is going on around this issue really relates to some of the peculiar practices of the NCAA and beginning to shed protections from that group? Because there are many critics of the NCAA within college athletics and outside. So help us to parse the NCAA itself.
Well, the NCAA, some people look at the NCAA wrongly as being this standalone association. What the NCAA really is a bottom-up trade association made up of its members. And its members are the colleges that vote on its policy. So whenever we hear the NCAA decision, hear the NCAA did this, or the NCAA did that, what it really is a collection of colleges. I mean, cast in a slightly different light, some comparisons to the NCAA just in terms of what they are in form. And I'm not talking about good or bad, but in form, they're not any different from, say, the National Realtors Association or the National Rifle Association. The people that are making the policies at the NCAA and voting on policy issues are the colleges themselves. And when we say the colleges are voting, it's primarily athletic directors and the coaches that have a vested interest in keeping the revenue from college sports in their own hands and not in the hands of the athletes.
When we do look at this issue, there are some who are strongly against it. Of course, you wrote a great piece some years back, 21 Reasons Why Student Athletes Are Employees and Should Be Allowed to Unionize. We'll talk about some of those arguments that you make, but let me throw at you some of the cons. What's the legitimacy to the argument that if only salaries were given, then the college student athlete would have to pay taxes?
I have a few responses to that. First, we live in a capitalist society, and while some people at the extremes may have views one way or the other, capitalism is the generalist way in which our country works. Now, within capitalism, there are certain restraints or rules that are put in place to make sure that markets operate efficiently. And one is that competitors are not allowed to come together and collude to restrain trade. So just to give a few simple examples that I'm sure all of your listeners would understand. Just imagine two big rival companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola. Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola can't come together and agree that they will charge the same price for their product. They also can't come together and decide that they will pay the same wage to their workers. And they can't threaten a boycott on the rival company if they don't agree to the wage-fixing restraint. If you look at the NCAA is a private trade association. It's made up of all the member colleges. Now, I am not arguing that any member school should have to pay its athletes. What I am arguing is that when 1,200 member schools that have the entire marketplace for college athletics have representatives meet in a room and they vote that not only do they not want to pay their athletes, but they don't want to allow any of their other competitors to do so either. That's a classic restraint of trade, and that goes against regular free market principles, and that goes against the American model of capitalism. And that would not be tolerated anywhere in society but for the fact that we're putting up this label amateurism and pretending that somehow college athletes don't have the same rights to the free market that all other American employees do.
Now, some suggest that at least you know what the scholarship money is supposed to be paying for in terms of a real education. A salary could be spent in any way that they'd like, and the argument is that look at so many professional athletes and how they have mishandled their newly made fortunes. What do you say to that?
You know, the world is filled with people that make bad financial decisions. I think back even to when I graduated from Wharton in 1999. I think about some of my classmates that took investment banking jobs, and they were spending more money than they even had in signing bonuses because they just expected to have more down the line. They expected to keep coming. We as a society do not play the role of determining how other people should spend their money. These college students, outside of a few freshmen, are adults. They are 18 years old. And if we want them to make good financial decisions, we want to encourage them to. I mean, if the NCAA wanted to say that they wanted all college freshmen or all students once a year, whether it be athletes or everybody, to attend financial workshops and to be advised about money and how it operates and the importance of saving, I think that would be a good thing. And if the NCAA deregulated some of its rules and allowed college athletes that were earning money to have agents and even recommended lists of preferred ethical agents that they think would help protect athletes' money, I don't think that's a bad idea either. But to simply say, we think you are going to make a bad choice so you can't make money, sounds very problematic. And if you think about the grander scope of this, college students work all the time in many different ways. We are not saying that we're not going to have student workers and work-study students in college because we don't think they'll make good choices with their money. There is no rule that prevents those that are not playing on sports teams from holding jobs. There are some college students who, as entrepreneurs, have started businesses and proven to be very successful. And we haven't turned around to these college students and said, you guys can't be working in businesses because if you make money, you're going to lose money. So it seems really pedantic and rather disingenuous.
What kind of ladder of cost would be built as the student athletes might commit to one school and then transfer to another because they got a better offer or better deal?
You know, it's certainly a possibility at some point in time that college athletes would want to transfer from one school to another. First, if we recognize these athletes as employees, they would be allowed to sign employment contracts. And contracts could be for a period of time as long as they're freely negotiated. You know, the problem, again, is when 1,200 member schools get together and they all decide that they want to pass the same set of rules. And as long as there's a formal agreement to that, that's collusion and it's illegal. But you pick any one school. Presume we deregulate the whole thing. Let's take Duke basketball for a moment. And let's decide, I think it's fair to say, that while Duke University is a very good school either way, part of the perceived value of Duke University comes from its basketball team. That the basketball team is a very good marketer of the university overall. And somebody could probably value the amount of additional revenue that comes into Duke University or the additional amount that they're able to charge in tuition or the amount of free advertisement they get from the basketball team. And we're probably looking somewhere in the area of several million dollars, leaving aside even direct revenue streams. Now, if Duke University, under a free market, were to say that there's a particular athlete who they think is going to be the top in their class, who they really want to sign to play for them, who they're willing to make a free market offer of several hundred thousand dollars per year to, but want to create a four-year contract and want to create something in there where that athlete will have an obligation to perform for 4 years, there's nothing that precludes Duke from doing so. Now, if they don't do so, it might be because somebody else offered that athlete a deal that's less restrictive or would have an out in it. But there's nothing that would prevent a school from saying, if you want to work for us, you have to agree for a term of employment of a certain amount.
Let's get back to the idea of money losers within college athletics and really answer the question that some make and request an answer to, that money to pay athletes might come from somewhere which might result in women's volleyball, for example, being cut or less of a commitment to Title IX. I mean, how do you respond to those concerns that people do have?
In terms of concern about women's sports being cut, I think you answered your own question. I mean, Title IX requires equal opportunity to compete in sports between men and women. So it simply does not mean that one team will disappear. Second, and apart from that, there are some college athletes that compete in women's sports that would probably be able to make money if there were free markets directly from the school and secondarily from endorsements. I mean, we're not only talking about Tennessee and UConn basketball, but if we want to be honest with ourselves, we've got to look at some of the gymnasts and perhaps some of the tennis players and even a few golfers on the college level. There's an even bigger issue here. And the issue is this false presumption that if college athletes were able to share in the pie, that these athletes would be the winners and women's sports would be the losers. And I think we have to look a bit more carefully at how NCAA member colleges operate financially to understand why that would not be the case. Now, just about every single NCAA member college is a not-for-profit institution. Because they're not-for-profits, what this means is you do not have shareholders. So if an entity is profitable, the money would tend to go to a shareholder. They would pay them out in terms of stock investments or year-end bonuses. It'll be fundamentally different in college sports. The money stays within the system. Now, because the money stays within the system, theoretically, some of it could be reallocated to places like a women's sports team or reallocated to the university academics overall. But if you look at the salaries of the athletic directors and coaches at the money-making programs, you could see that what would otherwise be profits if it was a for-profit institution are instead transferred to these coaches and athletic directors in the form of above-market profits, above-market payments, or quasi-profits. So just to illustrate the point for a moment, let's look at the University of Michigan football team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know, despite what happened on the field with Wisconsin this weekend, that the University of Michigan football team is one of the most successful programs in the country, not only in terms of wins and losses, but also in terms of revenue generated and indirect revenues in terms of prestige to the University of Michigan overall. Now, at present, if the NCAA rules prevent any member college from paying its athletes, a good amount of the revenue derived from Michigan football is passed off to their coaches. Just to be clear here, Coach Harbaugh, despite this week's loss, earns a salary in the neighborhood of $10 million, with an M dollars per year. Now, $10 million per year is more than almost any NFL coach makes. The college coach, more than the NFL coach. The offensive coordinator at the University of Michigan makes upwards of $2 million per year. Not only a lot of money in the general scheme of things, but more than the offensive coordinators make on most NFL teams. And the quarterback's coach, let's just understand who the quarterback's coach is. If you have an organizational chart, the quarterback's coach reports to the offensive coordinator, who reports to the head coach. So this is three levels down the process. The University of Michigan quarterback's coach is paid more than $1 million per year, which I presume to be far greater than any quarterback's coach in the NFL. What I presume happens if we move to a free market model is that instead of providing above-market payments to the coaching staff as a way to lure athletes, payments would be able to be made directly from the university to the athlete. I don't think the losers out of this will be women's sports or some other group that the NCAA wants you to believe it will be. Those that are likely to lose, at least in terms of the amount they earn, will be the coaches and athletic directors that are already earning far more money than their professional counterparts due to the system that's currently in place.
Okay, so it will be a few administrators, athletic directors, coaches, and in many cases, if it's a public university, and I am here in the state of Connecticut, they are the highest paid state public officials. But let me go back to the University of Connecticut with a very successful women's basketball program, and in the past, men's basketball, not so much with football. But the case in Connecticut, it has been reported that the athletic department lost $40 million at UConn last year and was being subsidized by the regular tuition for academics. What happens in that case, or is that an anomaly?
What are we talking about on average? Because there's a lot of revenue obviously generated by many of these Division I schools, particularly those that are strong in football. But what about those who are already losing money? And certainly $40 million can't be made up by cutting the salaries of just the athletic director and the coaches.
Well, there's a lot of fuzzy math that goes on here and a lot of fuzzy logic when we talk about some of these losses. And I think probably the best way to respond to this is not to say that UConn did not potentially have losses, but to really call into doubt the way that we're calculating what's a gain or loss. First, there are many departments of colleges that are not revenue generating, and many activities that colleges are involved in that are not revenue generating simply because they're deemed to be for the good of the university. My guess is if you look around the country, there are probably very few liberal arts programs in areas such as French poetry that are revenue generating. And if we looked at college activities, certain activities themselves are probably not revenue generating. Sending students around the country to compete in debate team is not revenue generating. Just about everything that's done on the student services side is not going to be revenue generating. So the fact that we're comparing a women's field hockey team, which is a very important thing for a university to offer, it's a hobby, it's an activity, it's a way of building athletic skills, it's a way of building leadership, and comparing that with a for-profit entity like a men's basketball team that makes it to the Sweet 16, I think we're mixing apples and oranges there. So that's point one. Point two is when you look at athletic team losses, you have to look very carefully at what are being called expenses. Now, some of these schools that purport to be losing money are the same schools that are paying many millions of dollars to their coaches. So it's difficult to run around saying we're losing X million dollars when a school is spending that same X million dollars on their head coach. So there probably are a lot of costs that could and maybe should be saved. Third, without getting to the specifics of UConn or any other college, you know, with the NCAA, many times we have fuzzy math. And the numbers aren't per se wrong, but numbers are often used to illustrate a story. And it's not necessarily clear that all of the revenues coming in are being associated to the athletic department. Perhaps there should be some allocation of revenue based on the approximation of increased number of students that come to the school as a result of there being big-time sports. Perhaps we have to consider the amount of money that's saved by not having to use separate advertising for the school because the sports team appears in the newspaper every day. So some of these statements, just purely in terms of dollars and cents, I think misstate the issue more than they really help us understand what's going on here.
In your compelling piece, the 21 Reasons Why Student Athletes Are Employees and Should Be Allowed to Unionize, you remind us, and this is pretty startling, that the NCAA produces nearly $11 billion more revenue than the NBA and NHL. And you can't help but think when you're watching television on a fall weekend and you see all the players who are at the trough as it relates to NCAA sports, except perhaps for the athletes themselves, that this is a remarkable money-generating machine for many outside of the university.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, I think that's one of the additional problems we have. I mean, sometimes we see comments coming out of ESPN or comments made recently by Tim Tebow, who is paid to advertise broadcasts. And you'll hear these statements in opposition to paying the athletes. Most of the people who we hear who are opposed to paying the athletes are the same people who are making money based upon the services of the athlete themselves. And as much as the NCAA likes to pretend that big-time college sports are just part of the general educational practices, you know, you watch a big-time college football game on a Saturday, or you watch the NCAA tournament on CBS on all types of crazy hours during the school week, you recognize this is a big-time commercial sports programs that are being operated by the member schools. And I don't think we could operate big-time commercial sports and then pretend it's not when we don't want it to be that.
Now, let me ask you this. We see so many of these court cases that are taking place right now. We also see that there are laws going through various legislative bodies here in America, particularly what's going on in California. That's what I think Tim Tebow recently was commenting on. Can you give us an update as to the Northwestern University petitioning the National Labor Relations Board to form a union? These were the students, the student athletes. And then some of the other court cases that are now working their way through. And then I want to talk about the legislation that we're seeing.
That sounds good. Well, first, on the unionization front, the Northwestern case at present is dead. Early on, the Northwestern football players that attempted to form a union got a very good ruling from Region 13 of the National Labor Relations Board. This being a subgroup of the full NLRB, and the Region 13 of the board recognized that these college athletes did constitute employees because they work for the benefit of their school very much under their control. Northwestern University, with the support and perhaps the prodding of the NCAA, then appealed that decision to the full National Labor Relations Board. And that decision sat and sat and sat. For a completely unusual period of time, the NLRB delayed on reaching a ruling. And they decided on that case in 2016, still under the Obama presidency and the Obama National Labor Relations Board. And in a very unusual opinion, the full NLRB recognized that while the college football players might very well be employees, the National Labor Relations Board has the right to deny jurisdiction or reject jurisdiction over any group of employees as a matter of public policy. Now, this is something that the NLRB almost never does. The few past cases I'm aware of this have been workers that were U.S. workers overseas, such as workers on the Panama Canal, where they didn't want to create conflict with the laws of other countries. But for what still confounds me, the NLRB said that it would subvert labor interests if we allowed the Northwestern University football players to unionize, because they're part of a broader conference, and many of the schools in that particular conference are public schools and not under the jurisdiction of the NLRB. I think National Labor Relations Board got that one wrong, and I think the decision was quite disappointing, but that ended the efforts for Northwestern University football players to unionize, and pretty much tells us that if a future group of college athletes were to attempt to unionize, they would need to form a bargaining unit that includes several schools and not just one. Perhaps an attempt to argue that a conference or the NCAA overall, which are private entities, are joint employers of the athlete. And perhaps one day we will see that again.
Why hasn't that happened yet, in your estimation?
A lot of factors. One is the challenge of getting a group to unionize. The Northwestern football players unfortunately took a lot of backlash, including from their own coach when they attempted to do so, which I found to be disappointing. Second, there is it makes a lot of sense, but it's a very nuanced exemption from antitrust law called the non-statutory labor exemption. Now, that exemption from antitrust law means that when a group is unionized, and antitrust law and labor law conflict, labor law would trump antitrust law and thus end any antitrust claim. For the past several years, there's been ongoing antitrust litigation to try to increase the rights of college athletes. First, Nobannon versus the NCAA, and more recently in Jenkins versus the NCAA, that is sought as a matter of antitrust law to overturn the NCAA's collective restraints that prevent college athlete pay. It is in the advantage of the college athletes that are plaintiffs in this case not to unionize prior to the case's final resolution, which probably plays a role in no future unionization attempts as well.
So we're talking about the judge in the Ninth Circuit? Is that the case you're referring to?
Yes, there were two Ninth Circuit cases, the first one being O'Bannon, which reached final adjudication, and the one right now, which is being appealed up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the combination of the Alston and Jenkins versus NCAA cases.
and explain basically what that is. I was reading that it only grants compensation for matters related to education.
That's not exactly correct. The O'Bannon case was okay with education, but the O'Bannon case, in essence, was decided not per se based on education, but because the NCAA lawyers produced a study. And that study argued that there would be a loss in consumer demand for college sports if the athletes received pay above and beyond the amount of education. And the plaintiff's lawyers in that case failed to produce a counter study. So it creates a factual issue rather than an issue at law that limited that payment amount.
Okay, I understand that. What about California? There are bills moving through their assembly which allow student athletes to derive income endorsement money for their image and likeness, and it's already passed the state Senate, but I don't know what kind of changes are being made in the assembly and where the governor stands on that. And I know South Carolina is working on this. Are they the only two states at the moment?
No. North Carolina and New York have bills that have been proposed too. But California is by far the furthest along. California's bill, the Fair Pay to Play Act, which is the bill number 206, has passed through all branches of the California state government. In fact, I was flown out to Sacramento to be a technical expert on the bill, explaining why the NCAA could not ban California member colleges if the bill passed. The bill currently sits on the desk of the state governor, awaiting his signature. So it's one signature away from becoming law. Now, one thing to note about that bill is, even presuming it's signed by the governor, which we think is more likely than not, the bill would not take place until 2023. Mm-hmm. And what this bill would do, this is not about colleges paying their athletes, which is a very controversial topic, and I concede that. The California bill is, in my opinion, a very healthy middle ground. The bill, if signed by the governor, will prevent any California member college from preventing an athlete at the school from being able to use their name, image, and likenesses for purposes of endorsing products. So there is nothing in the California bill that would lead to direct payments from colleges to their athletes. What it will do is it will prevent California member colleges from going along with the NCAA to prevent athletes from signing third-party deals. So you might see, once the bill goes into effect, the quarterback on Stanford University football team perhaps signing an endorsement deal with Nike. Or you might find a women's volleyball player being the lead endorser for the local pizzeria and getting some money from that.
And, of course, we see that already in college athletics, but it goes directly to the teams and to the athletic departments rather than to the student athletes themselves. Let me ask you about our senator here in Connecticut, Chris Murphy. He's written a white paper called Madness, Inc., How Everyone is Getting Rich Off of College Sports Except the Players. Of course, he's talking primarily about Division I. Can you explain to us what impact any of the changes or the way that society is beginning to look at this issue again and open up a real healthy dialogue about Division II or Division III in any of this?
Well, the proposed bills, such as the one in California, would allow Division II and Division III athletes to sign endorsement deals much like Division I athletes.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is there probably is very little, if any, market for these Division II athletes to sign with big commercial companies. But they probably, in some cases, again, will be able to sign very small deals with local businesses. Also, there is nothing in these bills which is talking about paying – there's nothing in the California bill that talks about direct payment from colleges to the athletes. And even if there was complete deregulation of the NCAA, the reality is many of these Division II and Division III schools do not bring in money, especially on the Division III level. I'm on the faculty at Baruch College, which is part of the City University of New York. We have a vibrant Division III athletic program. It's part of our student services. It's treated just like any other student activity. We have a very good basketball team on the men's side that's performed very well in the CUNYAC conference for the past several years. And we charge $0 and 0 cents for people to attend the games. So for a school like this, there isn't revenue coming in, and there probably would be no desire to pay athletes any amount of money because it would not lead to increased revenues. And for a lot of Division II and all Division III, I don't think we'll see very much change except for the occasional student athlete signing an endorsement deal and having a little bit better of a financial life while they're in school.
Attorney Edelman, a few more questions. Our senator, again, Chris Murphy, saying this is a political issue, whether you look through the prism of employees not getting paid or through the prism of a bunch of coaches and athletic directors and CEOs who are largely white making a bunch of money off of black basketball and football players. How would you comment on that?
You know, I hate to say that, but there is a lot of truth to this. I mean, if you look at the Division I football and men's basketball players, I mean, these are sports that are overwhelmingly African-American. Now, I can't get into the full legal history of it, and I don't want to ascribe intent where it may not be the fact, but the NBA has a rule that says you have to be a year removed from high school before you could enter the league draft and turn pro.
Right. Aren't they looking at that again, though?
They are, and hopefully they'll remove it. It was something that they put in place. They didn't have that for all time. It was deemed when the union didn't agree to it. In the early 70s, it was found to violate antitrust law, which allowed guys like LeBron James and Kobe Bryant to come directly into high school. When they put it in place, the NCAA was usually supportive of it. And the NFL has a rule that says you have to be 3 years removed from high school. And when Maurice Claret went to court to try to challenge the NFL rule, the NCAA filed an amicus brief in defense of the NFL position. By contrast to that, the U.S. sports, which have far lower African-American rates, including baseball and hockey, allow their players to enter the league directly from high school, which creates a viable alternative for them, other than having to provide free services. So it's hard to deny that aspect. Again, I don't want to overly play the racial hand here. I think it's one of many issues, but we also live in a country where, whether we like to talk about it or not, black is often a proxy for poor. And many of these rules that prevent college athletes from signing endorsement deals or earning money are more harmful to those who are low income. I mean, if you look at the rare player who's from an upper middle class, a wealthy family, it's not a big deal. And I think Josh Rosen has even talked about it himself. Josh Rosen's father is a physician, quarterback now for the Dolphins.
Yes.
If Josh Rosen, when he was in college, if he wasn't allowed to sign an endorsement deal, as unfair as it might be, he was still very able to enjoy a normal college life. Many other players who are from very, very poor families can't even afford to have their families come and attend the games. Or some of them have even said at times before the NCAA liberalized certain rules that they didn't even have enough food to eat. So I hate to call it a racial issue per se, but there's definitely a class element to it. And then throw on top the fact that, you know, black is often a proxy for poor in the nation in which we live, which would give it an indirect racial component.
I don't know if you want to comment, but the senator also wants to take on recruiting, the whole process, and the Power Five cartel. Is that something within your purview?
All I'll say at this point is kudos to the senator for doing something. For way too long, most members of government have turned a blind eye to the NCAA's practices, simply accepting them as they are and being afraid to go against the very powerful constituencies of their private association. I don't believe college athletes deserve any special rights. I don't think they should be treated better than anybody else, but I do believe that they're entitled to the same rights as any other member of society is entitled to. No member college should have to pay its athletes. But when 1,200 member colleges appoint someone on their behalf to come attend an annual conference, and these 1,200 members hold a vote, and they vote on what to pay the college athletes, and they agree on the sum of zero, and then they vote on whether to allow college athletes to endorse products, and they vote on no, when these same individuals that are placing these votes are making several hundred thousand, if not millions of dollars per year, and many of them themselves are endorsing products, there's something very wrong, not just morally, but legally under our antitrust laws. And kudos to Murphy. Kudos to Mr. Murphy for saying we need to change things. And perhaps there isn't just one way to change them. But it's an important first step to say the status quo is wrong, the NCAA's status quo is immoral, And certain things that the NCAA is doing with respect to curbing athlete compensation might even be illegal. And I'm glad that we have people now talking about it.
In closing, how much of this really, when we think about it as an equity issue, is about life after college for most of these student athletes who will not go on? It all stops right here.
I think at the end of the day, that is the big issue. You know, the current system is unfair, but not life-destroying to the select few who are stars in college and then turn pro and make many millions of dollars. But the system is colossally unfair, not as well as illegal, for the athletes who put everything on the field or on the court in college and make large sums of money for their university. And due to many factors, including potential injury, do not make it to the next level. And I'm sure for all your listeners that are big college sports fans, you could think of that football player or basketball player who is your favorite to watch for their years in school, who put their blood and sweat and tears on the field, who gave up more than 40 hours per week, and perhaps did not even study their ideal major to meet the demands of their team, who either due to lack of ability or even worse, an injury, do not have the chance to then compete even further and never walk away with a sum of money for what they've done. And I think the answer is let these people earn an income and endorse products when they have the opportunity to. Don't say they'll make it in the future because many don't. It's just the way the world works.
Mark Edelman, thank you so much for being with us today. A really interesting discussion and great insights from you. He's a law professor, attorney, sports business expert. If people want to read, because you're always writing about these subjects, how can they find your work?
Probably the easiest way would be to follow me on Twitter at Mark Edelman, MarkEdelman, and I regularly tweet out the work that I produce.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
My pleasure.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.